is The End User, episode 132 for Tuesday, April 23rd, a less irritating redesign. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Marr. And this is a great week for me because our top story this week is Google Glass. Now, we've talked about it before, these tech spectacles that you wear that have a little projected display on your, I guess it's the right side, you know, the right eye.
Yeah, it's the right upper eye. And then that's the position your eye is going to get stuck in if you actually wear these things.
Right. So we've known about Google Glass for a while, and it's been available to select top secret engineers working at Google for a while. But now it is available to, well, not people like you and me, but developers who were willing to pay $1,500 and go through a series of tests and background checks or something in order to get their hands on the limited number of these very expensive, very futuristic devices. So some of that has trickled down, and we've got the specs to it. We know exactly what's in it, what it looks like, and we're starting to see what people are doing with it.
Yeah, and I remember, so that very first story from The Verge, we got a real fine look into what this thing actually is doing, and it's a really interesting project, and I'm really excited to see where it goes, but I still have no idea where this thing is headed.
Right, but until now, we've barely even had an idea of what it might actually look like if you were wearing it, but now we do. We have the technical specs and the equivalent. So what it's like is, imagine a 25-inch high-definition screen, and you're standing 8 feet away from it, and it's positioned so that it appears a little bit towards your right, maybe 20, 30 degrees or so towards your right. And so it appears in the upper right corner of your right eye, and that's what it would look like. So there's always a TV there just 8 feet away from you.
And that just, to me, it sounds a little creepy. I wonder if... I wonder what the learning curve for this thing is. I mean, it's not just... This is not like a learning curve for a regular smartphone or something like that. I mean, this is really a different thing. And I got to wonder how long it takes you to get used to having that 25-inch TV off to the side, as it were. And I bet you it takes a while for you to learn to ignore it, right?
Yeah, and it's not even just about like getting used to it be there and learning to ignore it, but then... You have to control everything with your voice, or now they're saying it can support taps as well. So I guess if you tap the frame of the glasses, it can respond that way. But otherwise, everything is voice controlled. So like, how long would it take for you to get good enough with it that you could start taking a picture or a video and do it faster than you could on your phone?
So and we do have a couple interesting specs. We'll leave out the majority of the specs because it's kind of what you'd expect. You know, there's some flash memory and a chip in there. So, but I find it interesting. We've got a 5-megapixel camera and 720p video, and that sounds about right. It's not as high as some of the phones, but you have to imagine it's a smaller sensor, so it shouldn't matter.
Yeah. And it's a first-generation product. 5 megapixels and 720p sounds good to me.
Yeah, and for what you're doing with this device, that's plenty of density, considering how small the sensor must be.
Yeah, I'm going to play that phrase back for you in 5 years, and you're going to laugh at yourself.
Yeah, that's true. That's like, we'll never need more than 64K of RAM. It's crazy talk.
Who needs it?
I certainly don't. I could do this podcast on 64K of RAM.
So what other specs caught your eye?
The only other one that I thought was really interesting was the bone conduction microphone that they put in here. So it takes the audio off of the bone of your head instead of through the air. So you get a better sound coming through, less street noise and the like.
Yeah, I don't know if that is necessarily the case. I mean, it will be able to conduct audio more efficiently to your eardrum so that you'll hear what you need to hear. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it will be louder or block street noise any better.
Well, I do wonder if it will block the street noise better, not for you or the person you're talking to, but for the voice recognition system on board.
Yeah, maybe. I can't imagine it would matter all that much. I mean, if they're making these, if they're handing them out, the voice recognition must be about as good as Google can get it. And especially when it comes to voice recognition and Google, it's all about the algorithm. It's not about the device.
Yeah, but I bet you it helps a lot. So they're saying this is compatible with any Bluetooth-capable device, but there's a special companion app that is on Android Ice Cream Sandwich and up. So that is how you get GPS and text messages and stuff like that. So
right.
Are you looking forward to this being on the iPhone? Do you think this will be on the iPhone?
They'll probably have some sort of API, maybe an app. I don't know.
Yeah, I bet you they'll enable third-party applications to be made. So even the lowly 3% of us Windows Phone users will be able to use it. I'd imagine. I'd hope. I have high hopes, Taylor.
I'm sure you do, Chris. And, well, who knows how many people will be using Windows Phone a year from now, or a year or more, when the rest of us get our hands on Google Glass.
Yeah, I suppose so. So if you follow through in the show notes, we've got some pictures in the article here that you'll probably want to check out, because this is the first time that we've seen more than one person actually have an opinion about this, right? So it's definitely worth a look. So head into the show notes. We've got a link. I'm dropping it into the chat right now. So it's definitely the most interesting story of the past 2 weeks since we missed last week's podcast. So
I
think
although this was within the past week.
Right. So I think that'll do it from our top news perspective. Do you want to get us started on the afterburners?
I will. Are you ready? Are we locked in?
Hold on. Let me put on my seatbelt.
Okay, good.
Let's go.
All right. Now, if you were waiting for a Windows 8 laptop that had a quote-unquote Retina display, your wait is nearly over. Toshiba finally announced a computer with a 2560 by 1440 resolution on a 13-inch display. So that's just about the same as Apple's 13-inch Retina display MacBook Pro. And this one is a full pound lighter and a couple $100 more expensive. It's $1,600 for the base model, or a full $2,000 for a Core i7 processor and a touchscreen on that display.
Cool. So that seems pretty awesome to me. It's the same screen but widescreen as the MacBook Retina. So that's pretty exciting. It comes at a hefty price, though.
Yeah. Well, it's shortened horizontally as opposed to expanded. No, it's shortened vertically as opposed to expanded horizontally.
Right. Yeah, exactly right.
But pretty much the same as the 13-inch MacBook Pro.
And Kobo has announced its Aura HD e-reader, which is quite interesting. It's a 6.8-inch e-ink device that has 1440 by 1080 pixels. That's 265 pixels per inch. So
more Retina display stuff coming to e-ink in this case. Kobo has always been the has-ran more... open access budget e-reader, but now they've got the best display of any e-reader.
Hey Taylor, remember when I said the Galaxy Note 2 was too large?
Yeah, I remember that. I remember agreeing with you. So the Samsung Galaxy Mega, which just came out or was just announced, is now even bigger, and they are actually launching them in two sizes: 5.8 inches. So that's already bigger than the Galaxy Note 2, and 6.3 inches. And these are both phones. These are not tablets. These are phones.
So do you remember the Galaxy Tab was 7 inches? We're almost getting up against that.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure it's probably the effective screen size is almost identical.
So here in the United States, we have a handful of carriers, and Verizon is one of them. They're killing their early upgrade program. So they're changing the way their contracts work. So if you are a customer of Verizon, you'll probably want to check it out and see how this affects your contract.
Yeah, most of the carriers in the U.S., when signing up for a two-year contract, you can upgrade early. You'll still have the contract for the end of the 24 months, but you can re-up that and cut off the last 4 months or so of your contract by adding on another 2 years. AT&T uses a proprietary algorithm based on your standing as a customer and lets you know when you're eligible for an upgrade. And it's usually somewhere around 3 to 5 months. But Verizon used to have it. It's just 4 months. Like after 20 months of your two-year contract, you're eligible for a new upgrade. They're canceling that. And so I think this is going to start to be a time when people move away from Verizon. But it's a calculated risk on their part.
Yeah, and I really like what T-Mobile has been doing in this space. So we'll see if the little guy and the big guy can get along, or if T-Mobile is going to get some more market share out of this. It'll be very interesting to see.
True.
And speaking of the big guy and the little guy in another odd relationship, Google Fiber is coming out to Austin, Texas here in the United States.
Yeah, so they're announcing that they're building out their fiber network just like they did for Kansas City. And they're coming to Austin by the middle of 2014. But even before that, they will be launching Google Fiber in Provo, Utah. They're taking a backdoor here because a private company had already built a fiber network in Provo, covering most of the city, but hadn't finished it. And Google agreed to purchase the fiber network and fix it up and launch Google Fiber in Provo, Utah, probably before it even comes to Austin.
Now, one thing we didn't get a chance to talk about was the HTC One, which is HTC's new flagship device. And that they said that it was going to come out in March, and they're a little bit late, but it's out now for AT&T and Sprint. And no word on Verizon, and T-Mobile is going to get the nod next week. And it is currently April 22nd here, so we'll see.
All right, yeah, can't wait. Now, Voodoo had a break-in to their physical office, and hard drives containing password data were stolen. So if you use Voodoo, you should reset your passwords because a person is holding a drive with your password on it.
Yeah, and Bitcoin is in the news once again. We had a bit of a geek out a couple shows ago, and it looks like they had another crash.
Yeah, they've been up and down since we talked
very
about
volatile,
Bitcoin
yeah.
2 weeks ago. It got up to almost $300 a Bitcoin and down to something like $50. And it's been fluctuating ever since. But that's been too much for the number four Bitcoin exchange called Bitfloor. And they have shut down along with another one. Mt. Gox suspended trading, and another one was hacked. So Bitcoin, although it seems like it might be a good bubble investment, is really a shady place to do business. So be careful.
It's extremely volatile. I mean, it hasn't gone completely down the toilet, but it seems to keep bouncing back when these kind of things happen. But
right.
Man, Bitcoin is just fascinating.
Yeah. All right, now let's turn off the afterburners. We're done with those.
Yes, let's do, and let's get into the end user stories. We've got a handful of stories here, and we're starting off with one that you think shouldn't have even made the show.
Well, it's not official news, is it? This is a credible rumor from Mary Jo Foley at ZDNet's All About Microsoft blog, but it's no announcement from Microsoft.
No, that's right.
And there's no changes. But this has to do with the story we talked about a few weeks ago that they're calling Windows Blue. This is the big rumored service pack upgrade to Windows 8.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would even call it a service pack. It's almost like a feature pack because they're actually adding new stuff. It's not just...
All right, let's call it an iteration.
Sure, yeah, an iteration, just like OS X does, as you're used to. And,
right.
Yeah, they're going to add, if this is true, and it seems to be getting more reliable over time, they're going to add back the start button. I thought that this was never going to happen. I thought they were taking a real hard stand on it.
And I think they should continue to take a real hard stand, and indeed they might, because this is just a rumor.
Yeah. So,
but the one reason that I could think of that they would want to go back to the start button paradigm as their main way to use your computer is if people are adapting Windows 8 faster than they're buying touchscreen computers, because the whole tile interface makes a lot less sense if you're using it entirely with a mouse.
Yeah, that's true. And as Rennie there in the chat brings up, the start button that we're talking about is not the Windows 7 start menu, right? They're bringing back the start button, which will just open the screen formerly known as Metro. It'll just open that tiled interface for you. So they kind of serve the same purpose. So it's almost, to me, like, well, same difference. You know, I hit the start key and I start typing. But that was true with or without the button. But this will just be a very thin veneer. It's just literally a button. That's all it is. So I'm not sure. I know a lot of people are looking for this to be a, you know, some kind of panacea, this Windows Blue. And I don't think it's going to be that. You know, it's just a button that takes you to the Metro interface. I don't think that is going to fix all of your problems, because you're still going to end up in that interface, which I happen to like, but it's been very polarizing.
Well, I'm not even willing to make predictions on whether this button exists or not.
So another one.
But I will talk speculatively about what it means for Microsoft or for the end user.
Yeah. So another one, and then we'll get out of this rumor mongering, the rumor mill, as it were. We should have a new segment, the rumor mill.
We should not.
Yeah, I guess that's kind of antithetical to the mission of the show, I guess.
Yes. In my mind, it is.
If these leaked builds are correct, they're experimenting with putting back the boot to desktop mode. So people who don't use the start screen could just boot straight into the desktop. And the first thing that comes to my mind, albeit not terribly mainstream, the home theater PC user who wants to use Media Center or something like that, they previously had to install some third-party software, which, by the way, got millions of downloads. And they're apparently thinking about it, about including this. So another interesting one. They're softening their stance, as it were.
Yeah, and I think that they should really stick to their guns on this one. They had a direction that they were going. If they backtrack, that's going to be a long-term mistake, I think.
And if this does actually come down the pipe with Blue, I won't mind it. I'll probably use it. You know, I use a desktop with Windows 8, and I think it would be kind of welcoming to have the ability to boot straight into the desktop. But that said, it just really doesn't bother me that much.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to matter that much. Anybody with Windows 8 is going to get the upgrade. They're not going to avoid it.
Like I said, it's not this panacea. It's not going to solve all of your problems if you have problems with Windows 8. And I think even if it softens it a little bit, you're still going to struggle with this kind of dual mode of how the computer works. So, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what happens here, if our rumor mongering actually pans out to be true.
It will indeed. Now, a few weeks ago, we talked about Facebook Home, and it's available now to a select group of people who either have the latest flagship Android phones, or maybe they figured out a Cyanogen mod to be able to get Facebook Home onto their device.
True.
But one particular feature, the chat heads that we were talking about before, has come to iOS. So the latest version of Facebook for iOS on iPhone and iPad has these little chat heads in it. And I've used it plenty, and I like it. It's fine. It is by no means a revolutionary update. It doesn't change anything. All it is a different, slightly easier way to get to my Facebook messages, which I use occasionally, but not that much. Now, if I had Facebook Home on my phone and I had chat heads everywhere instead of just my Facebook app, that might be a little bit more revolutionary. I mean, it's like, you know, it's like having an IM window on your phone everywhere you go.
Yeah, that's way different. And I think, so it's not coming to Windows Phone, so I guess I can't really even offer up an opinion about what it means to have the app or the launcher or anything like that. But I think I just don't use Facebook messaging. Is that where all the kids are, or am I missing out? I've been using predominantly Google Chat for instant messaging, and I think the most of the people in the tech industry, at least, are all in with Google. But I think most people out there are not, that they're actually using Facebook chat more often than Google chat. So maybe I'm a little out of touch in that regard.
Well, like I said, I don't use Facebook chat that often, but it does fill a few in-between niches that you don't really have with anything else. One thing is that if you use Facebook, like most of the people who I know use Facebook, just about everyone you would want to talk to online is already your Facebook friend.
Yeah,
and that's true. You don't have to ask them for their phone number or their email address. And the other thing is that it's real time and asynchronous. So what I mean by that is there's no difference now between the Facebook messages folder and the Facebook chat that you have when you're actually on the website. All of those conversations end up in the same place. So you can begin a conversation like email and seamlessly transition it to chat or vice versa, right? So that is two particular use cases in that I use Facebook chat, and I find it to be much better and more convenient than either email or texting or calling or Google chat, because the only people I have on my Google chat are people who I've explicitly allowed to see me on Google chat, right? I mean, you can set it another way, but I don't want everyone with Gmail who I email to find me on Google chat.
Right. Yeah, you have to basically accept their friend request in Google chat.
Yeah, you have to limit it. But if someone is your Facebook friend, then you're probably willing to talk to them. And if you're not, then either you turned off Facebook chat or you are blocking people, which I guess you could do that too. It seems like a lot of work. It's more than just turning it off. But my larger point here is that none of that has anything to do with chat heads. Yes, you use chat heads for that instead, but the only thing it does is it cleans up that interface so that you can use it more easily either in real time or like email. Does that make sense?
Yeah, because there's this notion of them talking to one another, which doesn't really exist in the Gmail world.
Right. So what I like about it is that chat heads more accurately represents the way that people use Facebook chat, or at least the way that I use Facebook chat.
Right. It's a better I'd agree with that. I think it's a better model for how people communicate with one another.
That said, it's also incredibly annoying.
Yeah, I keep signing into – so Windows 8 has this messaging app, that, and Facebook chat is included in that, and it keeps signing me in when I don't realize that I've signed in. I'll have to definitively go in there and turn that off at some point here.
Well, so the reason I find it annoying is that when I usually have those asynchronous email-type conversations on Facebook – I don't need to see, you know, the heads of the people that I'm talking with on my screen the whole time.
So you just don't like the chat heads themselves, the way it's designed?
No, I mean, I can't imagine a redesign of it that would be less irritating. It's too focused on the real-time instant message type chat. And for that, I can see the value. You want to have, you know, just a little head there, and maybe it bobs up and down when it's saying something. And that's better than having an IM window, which would take up too much space on a phone or a tablet. But if you're using it like email, you don't need that little bobbing head following you around everywhere you go. I would be much more annoyed if it was something like Facebook Home, where those heads literally follow you all across the system.
Yeah,
but since it's just inside the Facebook app for me, I can deal with it. It's fine. It's more useful than the old one.
I feel like what will happen in the future is that they'll realize that it's kind of ridiculous to have a giant head to message with, and that they'll kind of back off on it a little bit and make it a little bit more utilitarian and a little less ridiculous. That seems to be the pattern of what happens. You know, so, you know, you come out and you're enthusiastic and you say, look, I've designed this. Look at this. And you're very proud of it. And then eventually you say, oh, okay, well, maybe I should back it off a little bit. And I wonder if that is what's going to happen here. But the general idea of what they're doing, I think is a good one. And I like the way that it would follow me around the entirety of Android. That seems very interesting to me. I think that is a new spin on instant messaging that is subtly different, but very useful.
Well, when you actually try it, let me know.
Yeah, that's true.
Although a lot of people are saying now that they are using Facebook Home on Android phones, they're saying that it basically turns your Android home screen into something much more like Windows Phone 8.
Yeah, I could see that. It's a little more stripped down. It's a little, you know, you don't get all of these insane widgets all over the place, which for some people I could see being a good thing. For others, not so much, though.
I think Microsoft and Facebook both have this idea that the emphasis on your home screen should be about people, not apps,
I see
not
what
messages.
You're saying.
Yeah, right? So that's the crossover there. That's the similarity.
So on Windows Phone, we're talking about the people hub in particular that is like Facebook Home. Yeah, I could see that. And that's a theme throughout Windows Phone. I mean, you don't necessarily go there and interact through people with Facebook. You just interact with people. And if you turn your phone into Facebook, that ends up being a reality, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting.
But I think at least I want some sort of differentiation in the way that I communicate with people. Like we were saying before, you don't want all your email contacts or your Facebook friends to have access to your Google chat account. So if you try to aggregate all those services on your phone and you don't even know which one you're talking to those people on, like I want to have some sorts of barriers between me and certain people who I interact with.
And will you name these people that you don't want to talk to publicly on the podcast? Or
I will not.
No, I'm just kidding. So that's interesting because I do use the People Hub on Windows Phone for a lot of things, but I still use a dedicated Twitter app, even though it has Twitter inside of it. There is something to be said about putting up walls between these different types of media. I mean, Facebook is basically private. I mean, I know it's actually public and anyone could take what I said and make it public, but Twitter is actually public and that's how I like it. And so if I got confused between the two, that would not be very fun. But I don't know. I think what Facebook is doing is really interesting. I like what they've done with Facebook Home, and it's not the same old Android launcher that we keep seeing, right? You know, a lot of these launchers are great, but they've really kind of gotten away from the typical and designed something special here. And I have no idea if people are going to adopt it or not. The reviews were terrible, but I like the idea of it.
I agree. They have, I mean, casting aside the comparisons to Windows Phone 8 for a second, Facebook Home is really it's a new paradigm.
Fresh.
Yeah, it's very fresh and it's interesting. It gives you a lot of ideas and it lets you do things much more easily than you could have before that. But that said, chat heads are not their crowning achievement here.
Yeah, probably not. So let's move on to something else that's a little fresh. Netflix has been taking another look at using HTML5 video as opposed to their currently Silverlight-based system online in the browser, not in the apps, mind you. But it's quite interesting. So they're looking at using HTML5 and JavaScript to stream the video. And you may think that's easy, you know, like YouTube does this. Why can't Netflix do this? But Netflix has a different set of requirements, really. They need DRM, and you could debate whether they need DRM from the studio's perspective, but as far as the studios are concerned, if you want the movies, you have to put the DRM onto it. And
right.
They're currently working with Google to roll out the some DRM JavaScript APIs that they can use in conjunction with HTML5. And they're going to do it in Chrome OS first. So that is going to be their platform until Chrome rolls out this feature called Web Crypto. So once Web Crypto is built into Chrome, they're going to start rolling it out to some of the other platforms. Because, you know, if you're only in Chrome OS, you're probably haven't gotten very far. But it's very interesting. And I applaud this in some way because I think it's time to move away from browser plugins like Flash and Silverlight. And
Silverlight in particular, it's starting to become obsolete. And as far as we know, Microsoft is not even working on a new version of it.
Yeah, I'm sure they're working in some kind of maintenance mode of some sort. You know, they're fixing things like security stuff. But yeah, I mean, as far as an exciting new platform built on Silverlight, certainly not.
Right. So this seems to me a natural extension. HTML5 was designed to handle this kind of web traffic, and that doesn't mean that it's going to be easy for Netflix. I mean, although it's the studios that are making it harder for Netflix by requiring them to incorporate DRM. But HTML5 is going to be much better in the long run for Netflix, and you know, eventually you would be able to watch Netflix from a browser on, you know, a tablet or a phone.
Yeah, well, that kind of brings up the question is, well, do they need a website? Or do they just need to be everywhere with apps? Do they need to be on Roku, iPad, Windows 8, Windows Phone, iOS? Do they just need to be everywhere? Or do they actually need a web browser anymore?
I feel like we can't have a discussion about that without having a larger discussion about web browsers are necessary at all. So I feel like we would be getting into dangerous territory. And my short answer is going to be yes, Chris. For right now, they still need a browser based software.
Yeah, and I feel the same way. So I think of the web as another platform in parallel with Roku. It just happens to be one that's accessible from all of the other devices that also have apps. So, it's just another platform, I suppose.
It's the main platform.
It's the main platform for the moment.
It's the platform upon which all others are based.
Yeah, I guess that's true, because the web with the browser is where all of the connected stuff began. Well, not really began, but took off.
Yeah, let's go with took off.
Yeah. So we'll keep an eye on this, and if we see anything move with HTML5 on in the browser in Windows and OS X, we'll keep you posted.
Cool.
So speaking of the web, I wanted to quickly run down a WordPress security vulnerability that's happened recently, just because I thought it was interesting, not for any other reason. But I'll keep it quick. The security is a really difficult thing out there on the public internet that is worldwide, and it's really hard to get it right. And it turns out that somebody out there has written a worm that is infecting WordPress sites. And what it does is it goes through and it uses the default admin username and just tries a lot of passwords. And then if it doesn't get the password, it just moves right along. So if you were using an insecure dictionary-based password, it would actually just log in, and then it would use that server as a launching pad to infect the next one. So one of the larger hosting sites out there for WordPress blogs, HostGator, estimates that about 90,000 IP addresses had been hit by this thing. So if you are a user of WordPress, you should go have a look and make sure that everything's still okay. But I just thought it was interesting. You know, something as simple as not having a password attempt cooldown period is what led to this.
And this
potentially
seems really
large
dangerous to me.
Botnet.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's already a large botnet.
Right.
As of 10 days ago, it was over 100,000 bots, all just cracking passwords on WordPress servers. And the problem here is that if they get control of enough of these WordPress server bots, then they can move on from brute force dictionary-based attacks to, you know, brute force every character attack.
Well, I think, so part of this is that the point is that you don't have to. There's enough low-hanging fruit out there that you can just take over, you know, 100,000 machines and really easily with because they used a bad password of some sort, and they weren't using a really strong, long password or some
right.
Perhaps some two-factor authentication or something like that.
But let's say this botnet goes from 100,000 to 100 million, and then they're running out of easily cracked passwords with username admin. Then they can start moving on to other usernames and more complicated passwords with 100 million computers.
Yeah, depending. So the question remains, what is the person who is the master of the botnet going to do with these things? And
well, that's one thing it could do. It could take over every single WordPress server.
Well, I don't know about all that, but if you
unless WordPress changes its security protocols before that happens, then yes.
No, I'm pretty sure they must have already updated this. It's not in the article that we're talking about here. They must have already updated this. But the
well,
problem
there are a
is,
lot of different versions of WordPress that
yeah,
people
exactly.
are on all their sites.
Exactly.
WordPress comes out with updates like at least once a month.
Exactly. So even if they have updated at this point, the likelihood of any one blog being completely up to date is not very likely.
True.
So anyway, I don't want to sound crazy security alarms out there. You know, this is alarming, but in the grand scheme of thing, it probably won't affect you a whole lot as the end user, unless you're running a WordPress blog.
In which case, definitely change your username from admin.
Yes, absolutely. That is the recommended course of action.
That is the first line of defense.
So change your Voodoo passwords and your WordPress login names.
Yeah. And if you use 1Password, you should also change your master password for that because they've been hacked in a serious way. And I've recommended 1Password before and I was freaked out and I went and changed it. But my account seems to be fine so far. But hey, our tip of the week gets into security as well. This is another way that you can be more protective of your passwords and your content. Two-factor authentication is available now from Microsoft, as well as Apple, as of last month. So Microsoft got it just last week, and if you use any Microsoft MSN, SkyDrive, Microsoft Online accounts, get two-factor authentication. It will make you way more secure.
Yeah, it is the prototypical way to thwart a lot of the really common kinds of security threats that, like the Matt Honan hack, the writer from Gizmodo. If you want
right.
to avoid that, this is how you do that. And Google and Microsoft both now offer it, and they both got pretty good email services. So I feel pretty good about where we're at.
Yeah, and Apple too.
Yes, and you're right, and iCloud as well.
And we just skipped right along my green tech story of the week. It's not so much a story this week, except that we are recording this podcast on April 22nd, and that's Earth Day. Happy Earth Day, Chris.
Yeah, happy Earth Day. This is a happy time of year for you.
Oh, yeah, it's a great time of year.
Well, also, just because it's
the Earth is really mad at us because, you know, we're destroying it. So that's what I say for Earth Day. Don't destroy the Earth today.
Right. Okay, and with that,
that's all I got.
that's a sobering statement there, but yeah, I agree. It's something we need to be aware of. So let's get into our app pick of the week. We've got a couple of them this week. What do we got?
Well, the big story this week is Twitter hashtag music. This is a new iOS app, and it searches through Twitter hashtags and finds music that might be interesting to you, and then it plays an iTunes Music Store preview of that music. So the only music you get to listen to on this hashtag music app is the preview that you get before you buy the song. But if you use Twitter or Ardio or Spotify or iTunes for your primary music discovery, and you were looking for a better way to discover the music that people talk about on Twitter, then you should download this app.
So I took a spin around the web interface, since, you know, I don't have an iOS device around the house here. But
oh, I didn't even realize they had a web interface.
Yeah, if you just, I think it's just music.twitter.com.
Okay, so how does that work?
So you just go there, and it shows you like a list of things that people are tweeting about. Not
right, just
not
like
your
music on Twitter.
Right, yeah, not your friends in particular, and you can click on any arbitrary cover art there to get a little preview of the song. And they've got and they've got some links to tweet about it and to buy it on iTunes. And sorry, I just blasted myself with music by accident as I was looking at it. But yeah, so you get a little preview of the song that you were after that people are talking about, and there's a little iTunes link and a little share a new tweet about it link. So it's a little bit cut down from what's in iOS, it seems to me, but it's at least a way to get your hands on it and to see what it's about, even if you don't have an iOS device.
Yeah. Well, the nice thing about the iOS app is that I was already logged into Twitter at the system level. So as soon as I downloaded the app and opened it up, it knew who I was and it pulled my friends list and it showed me the music that they were talking about. But that doesn't really matter to me because I don't use Twitter to discover music and I don't follow people because they talk about music. And therefore, most of the people I follow on Twitter don't talk about music that much, and I don't necessarily need the recommendations of those that do.
Well, hey, it's not Twitter's fault that you follow a bunch of geeks on Twitter.
Well, there are plenty of music geeks. And I guess, you know, if you're already using Twitter to discover music, this would make it easier for you to find and then purchase it. But if you have other ways of finding music and you don't want to rearrange your Twitter stream to find the music that you like, or alternatively, you can just use Twitter as a whole and Twitter music will tell you the popular music that's available for you to buy. You can use it one of those two ways, but I don't really look for music either of those ways. And so, in honor of that, we have two other apps this week that can help you find music in different ways. The first is another iOS app, and it's also available on the web, and this is called Piki, P-I-K-I. And it's a lot like Pandora, but the idea is not for you to just be able to listen to music based on an algorithm of the music that you like, but also discover and then listen to or purchase it.
Cool. So the next one we've got here is called TuneCrawl, and this is one that I dug up here. It basically allows you to search across many other music services. So, you know, it's not necessarily for listening, but if you know that you want to buy a particular artist or album or something like that, you can search across YouTube, and you can actually click through and listen on it. Or you can buy it on Amazon, or you can buy it on the Google Play Store.
This is a supplement to either Twitter Music or Piki or anything else. If you know what song you're looking for, if you know what artist you're looking for, but you don't know where to find it, TuneCrawl helps you get to that music as fast as possible. If you just want to find the music video on YouTube and just play it and listen to it and be done with it. Or if you want to buy it, but you didn't want to buy it on iTunes, you know, maybe it's on SoundCloud or Amazon or something. This will give you all of those options. You just search for the song or the artist or the album or whatever it is that you already know you're looking for. And TuneCrawl gives you all the options it can find for how to listen to it.
Right.
So it's a very useful service.
Yeah. If you're somebody that has multiple accounts at all of these places, then it can ease the friction between you and the music.
Right.
And you can use Twitter Music to discover that music, I suppose, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm saying. If you want to use Twitter Music or Piki or any other, you know, maybe if you want to use Pandora, you know, you can't necessarily find a song in Pandora and buy it right away, but you can find the name of it, and TuneCrawl will get to you to whatever version of the song you want, whether you want to buy it or just listen to it. You know, even it even connects to Spotify.
Yeah, cool. So there's a couple alternatives for you. Let us know what you think. I'd be very curious to see what the listeners think. So I guess that'll do it for this week. We're running a bit longer than we normally do, which is kind of nice. We had a lot to talk about.
Yeah, we had some good conversations.
So is there some kind of like Taylor Marr thing like TuneCrawl, but to find your social media networks that you're on?
Yeah, sure. TaylorMarr.com.
TaylorMarr.com.
Yeah.
And do you have TaylorMarr.com?
I do.
Oh, that's nice. See, I there's no way I could get myname.com.
Does that bowler have it?
Yes. Somewhere between the bowler and the graphic designer and the inventor of death metal, my name has been taken at all the places. So I just throw my middle name in there.
Wait, Chris Barnes, the inventor of death metal, is not you?
No, that's not me, surprisingly.
Oh, boy. I got some apologies to make.
All right, so... So I guess you could go to TaylorMar.com. I'm looking at it now. This is the first time I've seen it.
Yeah, I've just got it up in the last few weeks. It's a work in progress. But
this is new? Okay.
It's mine.
All right. Well, so how about Twitter? That's a little more mature place where you're actually...
I suppose. I've been on Twitter for 6 years now.
Yeah, way longer than me.
You can visit my six-year-old Twitter account at TaylorPhone. It wasn't always, but it is now.
All right, and if you wanted to get at me, I am at Chris Hale Barnes. So let us know what you think. And that will do it for this week. And thank you, everyone, for listening to the show. And, of course, you can find more information, including the show notes, at thedigitalmediazone.com under the end user. That's THENDUSR. The DMZ has a few other podcasts. You can have a listen to Entertainment 2.0, which I guested on last week, so that was fun, and Scene in HD and the Movie Podcast. You can send us some feedback if you'd like. The email is theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com, or you can follow us on Twitter collectively. We are @theenduser. You can join us as we record the show live every Monday night at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. I am your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Mott.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.